when could the first round of COVID vaccines be given in our country? We're learning about vaccine rollout, what it takes, what is known here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Friday, we learned Pfizer applied for emergency use authorization for the COVID vaccine with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The FDA says its vaccines advisory committee is set to meet in 16 days from now. Are you a frontline healthcare worker? What do you want to know about this ambitious vaccination timeline? Are you in the general healthy population? Will you get vaccinated? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Dyle Hewlett Jr. is an infectious disease specialist and medical director of the Disease Control Division and deputy commissioner at the Westchester County Department of Health in New York. Dr. Hewlett, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you very much for having me again. I'm very honored to be here.
Well, let's get the lay of the land here. Drug companies Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca have leading COVID vaccine candidates. Several others remain in the works and development. Break down what you know about the status of these vaccine candidates.
Well, what we know is very, very promising. The two candidates that are farthest along in development are the Pfizer candidate, which has shown 95% efficacy in the phase three trials, and also the Moderna candidate, which has shown 94% efficacy in phase 3 trials. Both of these candidates are very far along, and as you indicated, the Pfizer candidate is going to be applying for emergency use authorization with the FDA in a very short time. And if that is granted, then it is conceivable that this product will be available for use possibly as early as the end of December or certainly by the beginning of January.
Well, what does an emergency use authorization actually do? Can you break that down?
Yes, I can. Emergency use authorization means that you have usually a situation such as this current pandemic that is an emergency, a healthcare emergency, where lives are at stake and a product that has shown promise should be made available as soon as possible. The emergency use authorization occurs before the formal FDA approval of the product. And so there's enough data available, at least if the FDA feels that there's enough data available for them to review it very quickly and grant this authorization while the complete review is completed. That is, while the complete review is done, that actually is emergency use. While emergency use authorization is underway, data is still being collected. And those individuals who receive the product under emergency use usually have to sign a consent form similar to what is done when the clinical trials are underway, when an individual enters a clinical trial. So it is different than when the product has full FDA approval.
Yeah. What can you say to reassure people that a vaccine approved under an EUA is just as safe and effective as one approved under the biologics license application process, even though there isn't, you know, as much long-term effectiveness data going on?
Well, we have to say that we don't have as much information as would have when the full approval is available. However, you have several different groups of experts who are looking at this data. And I think that all of the scientists and other medical experts that are looking at this data, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is, of course, one of the leaders in the field, all of them have felt that the data that's available thus far is very favorable. And I certainly share that view, that from what we've seen thus far, not only in terms of the efficacy data from the products that have been reporting it, but also this, more importantly, the safety data. All of these vaccines, if they are going to be receiving emergency use authorization, will have to have a minimum amount of safety data available. That is, it's my understanding that all of the patients who were in this trial or all of the individuals in this trial will have been followed for a period of at least 2 months. And it's during that 2 month period that we would expect most of the common adverse events or side effects to occur.
We're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who's an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. He's fielding questions about a COVID vaccine and rollout, 800-642-1234. Emma is joining us from Eau Claire this morning. Hi, Emma. What is your question?
Hi. I was wondering, there seems to be some sort of a plan for who's going to get a vaccine first and where all that is. And I was wondering where college students are on that, because it is kind of a large group of people sort of stuck in a couple of buildings, especially with the dorm. And the college that I've been going to has already been shut down twice for COVID. And I have friends who have had to quarantine or have had to go into the quarantine dorms. And I've been just wondering where we are on that.
Yeah. Emma, thank you for that question. Great question. Dr. Hewlett, can you break down who would get the vaccine and when?
Yes, I can. I can't be as explicit about when, but I can share with you what I've learned about the ordering of who is going to actually receive the vaccine first. And as we understand it, our healthcare providers are first on the list. So those individuals who are physicians, nurses, technicians, individuals who are essentially supporting our hospitals and clinics and other medical facilities, our first responders, such as our EMS workers, and individuals who are also other first responders, such as our police and fire, they will be the first people on the list because of the essential role that they play in supporting our healthcare system. In the next group, I have been told, and we have learned, that that is going to include some of our most vulnerable populations, such as our residents of long-term nursing care facilities, residents, older residents of assisted living facilities. And I think then we will start to talk about the next group, which will be individuals who are possibly immunocompromised or individuals who have underlying morbidity factors, which place them at high risk or higher risk should they get infection. And these are people with underlying cardiovascular disease or respiratory disease, individuals with respiratory problems like asthma that would predispose them to poor outcomes if they should become infected. Now, certainly, as you have mentioned, Emma, individuals who are in congregate settings are certainly at a higher risk. And college students, as well as individuals who may be incarcerated, certainly fall into that category, as well as others who may be in congregate settings. But they would not necessarily be at the very top of the list, but certainly residents within a congregate setting is considered to be a risk factor for the acquisition of disease. And this is certainly being taken into account.
We're talking about what may be the most ambitious vaccination program in our history and about a COVID vaccine, what is known now. We have infectious disease specialist Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is on the COVID-19 Task Force on Vaccines and Therapeutics. What do you think of the work of Operation Warp Speed? Are you optimistic that a vaccine will work in stopping this pandemic? Are you working on vaccine distribution plans for your organization? Who has a seat at the table? What is your group talking about in logistics and who is prioritized? It's 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Hewlett here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what a nationwide COVID vaccine rollout may look like. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal government, through Operation Warp Speed, has been working to make one or more COVID vaccines available ASAP. The nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says public confidence in the vaccine approval process is key on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday.
So if you have a highly efficacious vaccine and only a relatively small 40-50% of the people get vaccinated, mm-hmm. you're not going to get the herd immunity you need. What we do need is we need to get as many people as possible vaccinated.
And we're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is an infectious disease specialist, member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. He's our guide. So, Dr. Hewlett, does the oversight end once a vaccine is authorized, or what happens once a vaccine is authorized in how you follow it and study it?
Yes, well, that's a very important question. And when a vaccine is under emergency use authorization, one of the terms that has to be met is that the sponsor or the manufacturer is obligated to provide safety information on all of the individuals who are receiving the product. And so, although it is not a formal clinical trial, the individuals are followed as if they were in a clinical trial. And so any untoward events that may occur to individuals has to be reported, and that information is tabulated, and that occurs during emergency use authorization. Even after the vaccine is fully approved by the FDA, as we understand it, the manufacturers are going to be under obligation to do what we call long-term safety studies. So these long-term safety studies may last for about 2 years, and during that period of time, the manufacturer is obligated to follow all of the individuals who are receiving the vaccine and to keep track of any untoward events that may be occurring and reporting these events to the FDA so that it can all be monitored. And so just because the vaccine has been approved, that does not mean that there's no longer going to be monitoring of safety and tolerability. One of the other things that happens when there's FDA approval, following FDA approval, there is also a review of the data by another group called the American Committee on Immunization Practices. We call it the ACIP. And that group reviews the data, and they actually make recommendations on the way in which the vaccine should be given. Who are the groups that should be receiving the vaccine, and what are some of the stipulations? And this is important because the clinical trials that have been done thus far have not included individuals under the age of 18, although there are trials that are ongoing looking at pediatrics. They have not included individuals who are pregnant, and that's very important because we know that pregnant women have been placed at a higher risk for having morbid events and even death as a result of COVID. And so this committee can make recommendations that may extend the use of the product beyond the groups that have been studied previously while data is being accumulated.
We're talking with Dr. Dial Hewlett, who is an infectious disease specialist, member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee, and we're exploring the steps of a COVID vaccine approval and distribution with your questions at 800-642-1234. John is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, John. What would you like to ask?
Yeah, hi. I saw an article last night on my news feed that the possible adverse reactions to the first shot when you get the vaccine, and if the doctors and vaccine manufacturers need to be honest about that, because otherwise people may be hesitant to come back for the second shot. As well, you get during the trials, were there adverse reactions like that, or have you heard anything about that?
So asking about adverse reactions and side effects, how transparent is that? What do we know?
I can start to answer that for John. And this is a very important question, John, and thank you, because the two candidates that are going to be out first, both of those vaccine candidates, both the candidate from Pfizer as well as the candidate from Moderna, they require a second dose. With one of the products, the second dose is to be administered 21 days following the first dose. For the second candidate, it is 28 days following the first dose. And you're absolutely correct. If someone has untoward events or adverse events or effects after the first dose, then they won't be as likely to want to come back for the second dose. What we know so far, and I believe and I'm sure, I feel very confident that the manufacturers have been very transparent about this. The most common adverse events that occur are very, very mild. And it appears that most of the adverse events that might be a bit more uncomfortable occur after the second dose as opposed to after the first dose. But things such as soreness in the arm, in the injection site, sometimes there can be what we call a flu-like illness, where a person for a day or so may feel like they have the flu. These are the kinds of things that have occurred. So far, very fortunately, for these two candidates, there have not been serious types of events that would really require halting the trial or anything of that nature. So we're very, very confident about this. But I do agree with you, John, that we have to make sure that that we adjust the expectations so that people know what to expect when they receive the first dose as well as when they receive the second dose. And we also have to make absolutely sure that people come back for that second dose, because if they don't come back for the second dose, then they are only going to be partially protected.
Well, on that issue of vaccine hesitancy, which is a major issue with COVID, and you've been talking about people being included in the study and the diversity of these studies, Black Americans are particularly hesitant about a COVID vaccine. And one study found that less than 20% of Black Americans believe that the vaccine will be safe or effective. What can you say about that and the needs of making sure that communities of color feel safe in taking these vaccines?
Yes, that's a very important question also. And really the purpose of the task force that I am participating in the National Medical Association task force, our job or our mission really is to serve as what we call trusted messengers, so that we will be able to pass along information to members of our community, because we want to be able to pass along objective, accurate information to our community. And I think that it's important for your listeners also to know that not only is this task force working with the National Medical Association and the African American community, but also other communities such as our Latinx communities, our Asian American communities, our indigenous Native American communities. We have been working with a coalition, if you will, that has been trying to design information that is tailored to the needs of all of these communities so that everyone will be educated about the vaccine and everyone will feel comfortable and confident when they go to get the vaccine.
Donnell is joining us from Fall River this morning. Hi, Donnell.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. My question is for you in regards to the vaccine on who's getting the shot. How do you determine if you are a caregiver, a non-family caregiver for multiple people, when you are going to be able to receive the vaccine?
So how do you prioritize in-home caregivers, Donnell, would you say?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a very good question, Donnell. My understanding is that individuals who are working, that is, home care givers, visiting nurses, individuals in this category, will, in all likelihood, be placed into the same category as the other healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, and others. We know that many of the home care givers, if they are providing medical care for individuals at home, many of these individuals are debilitated and are vulnerable. And so it's important for these individuals to receive the vaccine so that they don't pass on infection to others. So I would think, although I can't say for certain, I would think that they will be placed into the category of the healthcare practitioners and caregivers, and those individuals are going to be among the first groups to receive the vaccine or to be offered the vaccine.
Dr. Hewlett, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's an honor to be here and to share this information.
Dr. Dial Hewlett is an infectious disease specialist and a member of the National Medical Association COVID-19 Committee. Coming up, we talk with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call to discuss the historic rise in hate crimes in 2019 and what FBI statistics tell us. That's Attorney General Call after a news update here on the Ideas Network.